This is Jim Inkster. We have a busy show today, and we'll talk with Judge Darrell White and lawyer Michael Wolff about legislative matters, including the attempt to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act. Also on the show, actors Joe Crest and Jason Bale. They're getting ready for the Swine Palace production of All the King's Men. We'll hear from eye doctor Pam Williams about a battle involving ophthalmologists and optometrists that's ongoing at the Louisiana legislature. And we'll recap yesterday's tragedy in Boston and hear from Danny Bourgeois, the marketing director for the Louisiana Marathon. He was in Boston yesterday. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 or 297-5633, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In a few moments, we'll hear from Judge Darrell White and attorney Michael Wolff, and they will comment about legislative matters, including another bid to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act. But yesterday was a tragic day in America, in Boston. Headlines today, like the one in the New York Times, are indicative of the tragedy that happened. The war zone at mile 26, there are so many people without legs. Two powerful bombs exploded near the finish line, killing three people, maiming dozens, transforming one of the city's most cherished rites of spring from a scene of cheers and sweaty triumph to one of screams, bloody carnage, and death. Three Baton Rouge runners finished in the top 90, including a young man who finished number 22 overall, Adam McDonald. And with us for a few moments is Danny Bourgeois, who's the marketing director for the Louisiana Marathon, and he was in Boston yesterday. Good morning, Danny Bourgeois.
Good morning.
Well, you were not far from where the bomb erupted a few minutes prior to this explosion. What happened yesterday from your vantage point, which was near ground zero?
You know, it was a beautiful day, and the race was living up to and surpassing any and all of the hype of being probably the greatest marathon event in the United States. And Craig Sweeney and I, you know, he's the race director, and I'm the marketing director for Louisiana Marathon. We were watching the wheelchair and the male and female elites come in probably an hour and a half before, hour and 45 minutes before the explosions. We had actually gone into the store, Marathon Sports, just to kind of waste time and talk to a few people we'd met at the expos the 3 days prior to the race. We were there exhibiting our event. And then we went out and stood on the street right in front of those flags, those international flags, where you could turn to the right from Marathon Sports and see the Jumbotron. And then to the left, you could see the finish line and the grandstands. So we were shoulder to shoulder with people, kind of like a Mardi Gras parade or a big tailgate in Baton Rouge, just really enjoying the scene.
And then where were you when the explosions occurred?
You know, actually, we were at the airport after we'd stood there for about an hour. We were tired. We'd been standing up for 3 days, and we had checked out logistically and kind of from a marketing standpoint what the best of the best were doing, and we're comparing notes and decided we were just going to get back to the airport and sit down for a little bit, about an hour, 2 hours before our flight, and just get ourselves prepared for being home and the new week. And we sat down, and the news flashed and said that there was an explosion. And we had already been texting and talking with different friends who were in and around the finish, because we knew at 4 o'clock a lot of the guys that weren't in, you know, the elite, real competitive side, which we knew a lot of people from Varsity Sports were finishing earlier, but there were other people we knew that were finishing now, that all of a sudden our text just lit up and we were in the middle of it.
Shock for everyone, and certainly for those who were there. And what does this do as far as perhaps causing grief for runners across the United States, people like you who organize races? Will there be panic and fear about marathons to come?
You know, I think it's going to be the contrary. And we were talking about this, you know, on the plane and a few other conversations since is, you know, runners, especially those who aren't really hardcore competitive runners, they run for a cause. You know, this hour, the 3:30 to 5 o'clock, 5:30 hour after the start of a marathon, those are your charity runners, people who run for a cause. And, you know, New York City Marathon, I think they claim that each year they raise $1 million a mile for charities. We've raised $65,000 and maybe $70,000 a year for our charity partners by people running the event and raising money. So I think what's going to happen is, you know, as early as this weekend coming up and for many years to come, we'll probably see a lift in runner registration and spectatorship, because we don't want to see these cowards win. And runners now have a cause to run for, not just for Boston, but for all victims of acts like this. We don't want these guys to win. So I think more people will run.
Well, the 2014 Louisiana Marathon will be when and where?
It's in January 19th. We're always Martin Luther King Day weekend. The last 2 years, we had runners from 46, 47 states and 11 countries. And with help from Louisiana Travel, Visit Baton Rouge, and the BP Seafood Fund, you know, we're going to be at a lot of expos around the country. We have been. That's why we were in Boston. And we expect our event to probably double in size. And safety and making sure that we're working with our local police has already been on the table for the last few years, but I'm sure this year we'll take it up a few notches, as will other races. But I fully expect that that all races will bounce back stronger moving forward.
All right, Danny Bourgeois, thank you. He's the marketing director for the Louisiana Marathon. Appreciate your comments. I'm glad you made it home safely.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, too.
Take care, Danny. And studio now, Judge Darrell White, retired judge, and attorney Michael Wolff, who has been the voice and face of the Libertarian Party in Louisiana for many years, and they have been on this show a few times with each other and sometimes without each other, but they're here today in studio to talk about some legislative matters, including the Louisiana Science Education Act. Yesterday, by the way, was an interesting day at the Louisiana legislature, as the week started with Governor Bobby Jindal's tax swap proposal being shelved by the House Ways and Means Committee, and a new lawmaker who was prepared to offer his first bill, which was the tax swap, Barry Ivey, a Baton Rouge businessman, was not too happy about the occurrences of yesterday. Here's Representative Ivey on what happened.
I'm a little disappointed today that there won't be any bills through this committee today to actually have the discussion on tax reform. There's a lot of people for tax reform. They just happen to be working and paying taxes right now. So they couldn't be here today.
You could hear an audible groan in the room as Barry Ivey started to sound somewhat like Mitt Romney. Why don't we start with taxes, and then we'll get to the Science Education Act. Mike Wolff, you're a libertarian. Were you enthused about the governor's plan?
No, I wasn't. I'm very concerned about taxation, have been for many years. The tax system in Louisiana is very unfair, but what amazes me the most is how little the legislators concern themselves with the fairness of the tax system. That is, we've got this huge set of exemptions, tax breaks, tax expenditures burden the budget every year. In this past year, a committee was appointed to study all of the tax breaks in our system, and found that there were way too many of them, yet they propose no change because supposedly there are too many interest groups that favor all of the little tax incentives that they have. But really, if we would impress the country if we adopted a rational tax system that had no special breaks in it. All That's right. What I'd like to see.
Judge Darrell White, did the governor bite off more than he could chew this session?
I can't really profess to an expertise on that subject, Jim. I do remember what Russell Long quipped often, "Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree." And so where you stand depends on where you sit on a lot of these taxation issues. There's one proposal that I heard Woody Jenkins make at our Ronald Reagan Newsmakers Luncheon last week that I think has some merit, and that is to parallel what Texas and Florida have done with the homestead exemption and exempt home seizures. That is, a person's home could not be seized and sold except for delinquency in the mortgage or in the property taxes. Delinquencies in mortgage or property taxes, but otherwise make Louisiana, like Texas, like Florida, a haven, if you will, for retirees so that they know they can hold on to their home.
Well, this is an issue that still has some legs in this session, and you can bet there will still be other tax measures that are reviewed, debated, and voted upon by the Louisiana legislature, and we'll follow it right here. Now, one of the issues that is coming to a theater near you is that old proverbial Louisiana Science Education Act, which has passionate defenders like Judge White and detractors like Attorney Michael Wolf. Mike Wolf, do you think any bid to repeal this law will go anywhere this session?
I have to be skeptical because of the strong amount of support it's received in the past, but I hope so. I hope we will defeat it and finally repeal this silly thing that is another black eye for Louisiana. Again, Gentle says that we're showing our best face when we cut taxes and privatize education. I'm all for intelligent privatization, but to try to enshrine religious beliefs in our legal system, our criminal law, and our educational laws is just the wrong message for everyone. It's like in telling people we're going to be like the Taliban in North Korea. We're going to add religion to all parts of our legal system, and we're going to be ruled by the church rather than the state. But come on down here and live here and be in a modern country, a modern state, a modern jurisdiction. To me, that's ridiculous. All They're just contradictory.
Darryl White, is Mike Wolf spewing common sense or nonsense?
Well, actually, I thought I was coming here to accept an apology for the lawsuit that was not filed. It's now been, by my count, 1,756 days since the effective actuality of the Louisiana Science Education Act, and there's been absolutely no litigation. As a matter of fact, the pendulum is moving in the other direction. Tennessee, effective April 20th of 2012, Tennessee passed its own science academic freedom legislation, very popular there, no litigation. It's been over 5 years since Ouachita Parish has passed science academic freedom legislation, and then the community of Central last fall passed similar legislation. So I would say that the pendulum is swinging in the other direction towards academic freedom. And, of course, the law itself forbids any instruction in the area of religion. So that's just simply not that's a straw man.
All right, 2975633. Or Inkstershow at WRKF.org. Here's a question sent from Edwin saying, do they approve of Governor Jindal saying in his interview, writes Edwin, with the NBC Lady reporter that he supports the teaching of creationism and intelligent design in public schools?
Well, what I would say to that is that the C word that I believe Jindal is talking about, and it's the C word that I talk about, is criticisms. Criticisms, objections, weaknesses, difficulties, and imperfections, because that's what Darwin himself, in his book, Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, that's what he talked about in three of the 15 chapters. And, of course, Jim, I heard you yesterday talk about favoring primary sources, and Darwin himself in that sixth edition in chapter 7, which he added in 1872, he added a chapter 7, Miscellaneous Objections, and he talked about an esteemed zoologist by the name of St. George Mivart, who raised quite an interesting objection.
So you're saying Darwin would not embrace the theory of evolution?
No, what I say is Darwin would do just what his introduction says, and that is a fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing all of the facts on both sides of each question. That's in the introduction to Origin of Species.
Mike, we're going to the break, but any thoughts? Did the judge score any points with you?
No, but on a point of information, I wonder if the judge could explain to us how many school districts have actually implemented the Science Education Act by providing supplemental materials on the subject of evolution or any other subjects.
All right, we'll get to that when we return after this timeout, 297-5633. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Michael Wolf, attorney, and Judge Darrell White, retired judge. They're here on opposite sides of the ideological spectrum, discussing the Louisiana Science Education Act and more. And Judge White, Mike asked you a question as we went to the break about the number of schools that are actually using these supplemental materials. Do you have any idea?
Well, it's up to the individual parish school boards whether or not they're going to formally adopt the supplemental materials pursuant to the Louisiana Science Education Act. Other jurisdictions, for example, Ouachita and Central Community, and even the state of Tennessee, did not run things through the State Board of Education, as did Louisiana. I can't tell you that I've got a figure today to know how many boards have done this, but I'm confident that teachers are getting around the terrible textbooks. They really are terrible, Jim. For example, they say such things as, and I've got a page here from one of them, that bacterial flagella are simple structures, and they give a really very rudimentary illustration where we know now that bacterial flagella are immensely complex systems with a motor that has been called by a Harvard professor the most complex motor known to man, spins at 100,000 RPMs, can change direction in a quarter turn.
Would you Judge, that most scientists are not in your camp on this issue?
That most scientists are not in my camp. Well, I don't think science has ever been advanced by a nose count. I really think it's falsification.
Science is falsification?
No. It's holding theories up to falsification and learning what is the truth on the basis of what does or what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that's what the problem is. We don't differentiate in the textbooks between observable science and forensic science, that is historical science, because nobody was there. No one can really test macroevolution.
Now, there was an event over the weekend at LSU called Speakers at Reason on the Bayou, a secular convention. The university's Atheists, Humanists, and Agnostics Club hosted the event in the Student Union, bringing together people of all types. The itinerary was filled with speakers who discussed issues like LGBT rights, the repeal of the Science Education Act, and the use of Christian textbooks in Louisiana schools. Did you attend that event, Judge White?
No, I did not. But
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Judge White and Mike Wolf.
Good morning, gentlemen. Judge White, I want to personally thank you for wiggling around the Constitution and allowing proselytizing in Baton Rouge public schools. My son attended the school that was allowed to come in on every Wednesday with Domino's pizzas and proselytize to the students. That's unconstitutional, sir.
Well, look, I bring a copy of the Constitution to give it to Jim and to Mike, and you probably have one online. So tell me what portion of the Constitution is violated by teaching the controversy in the area of origin science.
Is this a violation of church and state, Mike?
I think it is, and the tradition of separation of church and state is not expressly stated in the Constitution, as Judge White will quickly let anyone know, but it is part of the tradition of this country. The main thing is that education should be objective. Mm-hmm. It should be based on scientific principles. This matter of falsification is, of course, a very important part of scientific learning. It means that beliefs cannot be established unless they're subject to being disproved. And we establish them when they're not disproved over a period of time. But the if you make a proposition like the universe was created by a God spirit, you can't disprove that. So that's not a scientific proposition. It's a religious proposition. And that spirit should be everywhere in our education system. We should be trying to apply facts to observable phenomena and drawing logical conclusions, not indoctrinating people in unfalsifiable beliefs, in other words, unscientific beliefs.
I do agree with Mike on that. In fact, I agree with the ACLU that has gone on record, along with the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, that, this is a quote, any genuinely scientific evidence for or against any explanation of life may be taught. And I'm for that. And let's have the criticisms, the objections, the weaknesses, the difficulties, and the imperfections of Darwinism brought out, so that in a court of law, Mike, if you were in court pleading your case, you would want to have cross-examination. You wouldn't simply be content if it was just direct examination. And that's a principle of law. Relevant evidence is evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of a lawsuit more probable or less probable than it would be in the absence of such evidence. And sadly, our textbooks do not do that. So supplemental material is really appropriate to do right. that.
Here's a note from Zach Coplin, the young man who's led the fight to repeal the Science Education Act. He's now at Rice University. He says, Senator Karen Carter-Peterson has filed Senate Bill 26 to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act, a mismanaged and misguided creationism law. Since its passage in 2008, the Louisiana Science Education Act, writes Zach, has been the subject of national and international criticism and ridicule, and its repeal has been endorsed by an overwhelming consensus of scientists and educators and a broad coalition of religious leaders and clergy. This is Senator Peterson's third attempt at repealing the law. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Trudy in Goodwood, please be brief. Trudy, you're on the air with Judge White and Mike Wolf.
Yes. Am I on now?
You are on.
I just wanted to mention that in Darwin's time, we knew nothing about the workings of DNA and the science of genetics. That came about 100 years later. So Darwin couldn't possibly have known that in his own time.
All right. Does she make a good point, Judge White?
Well, yes, indeed, she does make a good point. And Darwin did not have the electron microscope. He would be very interested in the type of things that are available now. For example, I was saying that in his sixth edition, the last edition he published before his death, he mentioned an esteemed zoologist, a fellow by the name of Mivart, and he even referenced Mivart's objection to Darwin's theories, and that is, and here's the buzzword that is in Mivart's own book and in Darwin's book, on the incompetence of natural selection to account for the incipient stages of useful structures. In other words, those formative stages. Today, that very argument is made by bright professors like Michael Behe in his book, seminal book, Darwin's Black Box, on the rationale of irreducible complexity. That is, mm-hmm. what does that bacterial flagellum do with that tail structure while it's waiting for those other 39 moving parts to be assembled? Because right. functionality is the hallmark of Darwinism.
Here's a question posed by Dr. Edward Richards of the LSU Law School. He is the director of the program in Law, Science, and Public Health. He says he's talking about the IBM location to Baton Rouge with its call center, saying high-tech people do not want to be in an anti-evolution, anti-gay state. Mike?
Well, that's the point I was making. It's a part of the same point. We make ourselves attractive to other states and to people thinking about locating businesses here when we show progressive attitudes. And by that, I don't mean socialist or left-wing attitudes, but I mean attitudes that reflect a positive, constructive approach to longstanding problems. And there's no issue area more important than education. And we say we're building a first-class education system, yet we pass bills like this, the Balanced Treatment Act. This is the Science Education Act comes at the end of a long series of efforts by the legislature to inject creationism, creation science, and other religious beliefs into our education system. And that is exactly the wrong message to send, as the caller was implying.
All right. Julie downtown asks Judge White and Mike Wolf your thoughts about the One Baton Rouge resolution. Do you have any position on this, Judge?
Well, you're going to have to be a little more explanatory about what you're talking about. If you mean by that, should we be sorting people according to how and with whom they choose to have sex. No, I don't believe we should.
All right. Well, let me read the resolution. It says the city of Baton Rouge and parish of East Baton Rouge, it says has, it actually should be have, a strong commitment to diversity and equal opportunity for all of our citizens, including acceptance and integration of people of all races, sexes, creed, colors, religions, ages, ancestries, disabilities, sexual orientation, nationalities, marital status, political affiliations, and people of all abilities and all walks of life in every aspect of Baton Rouge community life so that we will all be enriched by one another. Do you like that or not?
Well, I have 7 children, 7 grandchildren. I think pedophilia is disgusting. That's a sexual orientation.
There's nothing in here about
pedophilia. According to the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which lists paraphilia, pedophilia, that is attraction to children, is one such paraphilia.
It's also a crime, Judge.
Well, immorality. Well, so for that matter.
So
on
we're
the
not
books
talking.
Today,
we know we're not talking about
nature.
That.
No,
you
no,
know
I don't.
That.
I do not know that. I do not know that at all. As a matter of fact, there are many who.
So you're saying that by virtue of the mention of sexual orientation, we're talking about pedophilia?
Well, sexual orientation, so far as I can tell, there's really never any definition of it. I think it means erotic attraction. And for that reason,
sexual orientation means erotic attraction. I think it just means whether you like people of the same sex or opposite sex, or maybe you're asexual.
Because of its the fact that there is no real clear definition, and because of the fact that immorality doesn't stand still, and the prospect that pedophilia and other very antisocial things could come in the wake of relaxation of standards. That's why the Louisiana Supreme Court back in the 1995-96 time frame removed that term, sexual orientation, altogether from several references in the Code of Judicial Conduct. Specific instance of the Louisiana City Judges Association and the Louisiana Family and Juvenile Judges Association.
I want Mike to respond.
Well, I think the resolution is pretty harmless, really. As I understand it and interpret it, it is just an expression of community values, saying that we intend to treat everyone fairly and not discriminate improperly against any group. And the reference to sexual orientation seems to refer to the question of whether people are homosexual, bisexual, or heterosexual. And so I see it as a harmless statement.
And I think most people who would read that would think it would be relatively benign and something that would be progressive. But there is enough support on the Metro Council that Judge White and people who of his mind on this issue are winning the day. Does that say anything one way or the other about our community?
Well, I on the area of science, someone talked about IBM and so forth. I would encourage all your listeners to do a Google search of a film that's online called Programming of Life by information scientist, holder of 2 PhDs, Donald Johnson. It's a 44-minute video, and it's fascinating. And it shows quite, I think, convincingly how complex life is at the cellular level and raises some very serious questions about the prospect that any amount of time, 15 billion years or otherwise, could bring order out of disorder.
All right. Here's the question from John Rice. He says, in past appearances when Judge White has been on the show, you have asked him about how old the Earth is, and he's gotten extremely upset. How old is the Earth, Judge White?
Gee, well, let me ask John and ask you fellows and ask your listeners, what are the assumptions associated with all age dating methods? I think before anyone can talk intelligently about that, they have to know what those assumptions are. Number one, the assumption is known initial boundary conditions. That is, how much radiogenic lead is in the sample you're testing. Number two is an isolated system that does not allow for the...
Let's say all that is correct. How old is the Earth then?
Well, Jim, I want to know I'm talking to an intelligent person on this subject. An isolated system is the second assumption.
Well, you were asked a simple question. How about a simple answer?
Well, I don't think it's relevant to the subject we're discussing right now.
You don't?
But I sure would like
you
to.
Don't?
I think those assumptions are, though. Those assumptions, which are known initial boundary conditions.
We're talking about evolution and science, and we're not on the same topic when we discuss the age of the Earth.
Well, I think that's very much a topic that interests a lot of people, because it has to do with the whole issue of whether or not we can believe evolution, macroevolution, or whether or not there are problems with it. That's why I would commend everyone's attention to Programming of Life, the video.
Well, why don't you give us an answer?
But why do you
want
to know?
I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer. I'm just curious. You're an educated man. You have a point of view on this subject. How old is the Earth?
Well, I think really what we need to stay focused on are the facts, and not my opinion on that issue. I certainly am willing to talk about those assumptions, though, because they're very keen interest as to what are those assumptions, and their known initial boundary conditions, an isolated system, and a constant rate of process, and every age-dating method known to man.
All right, so we're not going to get an answer from Judge White. Mike Wolf, approximately how old is the Earth?
It's 30 billion years old or something like that. This question is, of course, used often to separate fundamentalists from objective people in discussing the kinds of issues we're talking about today. I think in this last presidential race, Rick Santorum was presented with it at one point, and they usually dodge it, and so does Bobby Jindal. Basically, what people like Governor Jindal will say, I believe, is that that's a scientific matter. I'm not a scientist. Ask the scientist. But it really raises the question. It's meant to reveal whether the person being questioned is deriving his opinions from the Bible, from a religious text of some kind, or whether he's deriving it from objective evidence. And basically, anyone deriving his opinions from objective evidence will believe the Earth is very, very old, as all the scientists tell us. But if he's believing it that the Bible is literally true, he's going to say it's a very young planet.
Here, Kobe Menard asks, why do conservatives bring up pedophilia when discussing homosexuality when the vast majority of pedophiles identify themselves as heterosexual?
Well, pedophilia is a paraphilia within the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's deviant behavior, in my judgment. It is criminal. And for that reason, I don't want to go there. And any loosening of the standards are fundamental to all societies, Jim, if we look at history, the relaxation of
but
sex
would
outside
you agree,
of marriage.
Would you agree that most pedophiles are heterosexuals?
Actually, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But the relaxation of sex outside of marriage is a culture-destroying behavior.
Mike Wolf, you get the final word.
Well, just concerning sexual orientation, it really is a slander on any homosexual to suggest that that it is inherently a sexual perversion. We don't consider heterosexuality perverse just because some heterosexuals engage in rape and pedophilia and so forth. So that homosexuals shouldn't be smeared with pedophilia and things of that nature.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today, and we'll see where the Science Education Act repeal attempt goes with Senator Karen Carter Peterson, who also happens to be the chair of the Democratic Party. We'll return with another issue permeating in the legislature with Dr. Pam Williams, ophthalmologists and optometrists are fighting one another. We'll find out why, and we'll also hear from actors Joe Crest and Jason Bale. This is Jim Eagster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Kevin Gallagher producing, and our guest at this time is Dr. Pam Williams. She's in Baton Rouge, and good morning to you, Dr. Williams.
Good morning, Jim.
And you are an ophthalmologist, correct?
That is correct. I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist here in Baton Rouge.
All right. Well, a story that has been discussed over the last few days is one that is looming in a House committee about eye care. When the House and Health and Welfare Committee reviews the bill, it potentially would broaden the scope of medical procedures that optometrists are allowed to perform on their patients. Now, optometrists are on one side, ophthalmologists on the other. Why so?
Well, On the ophthalmology side, we feel that this is a patient safety issue. So ophthalmologists are actual medical doctors. We go to medical school. After undergraduate education, we go to medical school. Then we perform we do a year of internship and 3 to 5 years of residency and fellowship, where optometrists go to 4 years of optometry school. So there's a very large difference in the training, and we feel that this is a patient safety issue to allow optometrists to do surgical procedures on the eye.
Well, there are those who believe, optometrists in particular, that it would improve access to eye care, particularly in poor and rural areas of the state. Your response to those statements?
Well, in a recent survey that's been done by about 500 Louisiana voters, basically the Louisiana voters, they want to see a qualified surgeon. Access is not really an issue for them. If they need the eye care, they are willing to go to where that appropriate eye care will be obtained.
Well, do you think the House Bill 527 has a shot of passage? The attempt to keep things as they are is evident by virtue of people like you coming forward to defend the status quo.
Well, I do think it has a shot at passage. I think that there has been There's some misunderstanding between the difference between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist. We are working very, very hard to educate people that optometrists do not go to medical school, that ophthalmologists are medical doctors, and we're surgeons, and we are physicians. I think that the citizens of the state don't want this to pass, but I fear that within the committee and possibly within the legislature that there may be some misunderstanding of what this would really provide for the citizens.
James Sandifer, the executive director of the Optometry Association of Louisiana, which has about 400 members, says this will increase access to improved eye care for the people of Louisiana. It's that simple. Your response to those who say, look, this is not something that's going to reinvent the wheel, it's not going to endanger patients, why should you be opposed?
Well, I think that it is dangerous to patients. For one thing, that what the bill does is it basically excludes some procedures, but there are approximately 350 eye surgeries that a resident learns in ophthalmology residency. So it does exclude a few procedures. However, it doesn't exclude a significant number of procedures. The other thing is that ophthalmologists are the surgeons, and the surgeon should be the ones performing surgery. The third thing that the bill does is that it basically puts it's an optometric blank check to practice medicine. It puts everything under the optometric board. It allows them to expand their practice as necessary. It takes it out of the hands of the Louisiana Board of Medical Examiners and puts everything under optometric board as far as the optometric procedures.
Well, we will follow it with you, Dr. Pam Williams. Thank you for joining us today. And when is the committee going to hear this measure?
The committee is going to hear the measure tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday, at 1 o'clock. And we encourage anyone who does not want surgery performed by non-surgeons to come out and support the ophthalmologists. Ask your representatives, call your representatives, and ask them to vote no on House Bill 527.
All right, that's the House Health and Welfare Committee, and for those on either side, for or against, we encourage you to let your voice be heard, and if you can, make it to the committee tomorrow afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Pam Williams. Good to visit with you.
Thanks.
And we're joined now by two gentlemen who are on stage at Swine Palace, and the opening night is tonight for all of the King's Men, Jason Bale and Joe Crest, two veteran actors who are in this production that has been a legend of Louisiana and the nation. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Joe Crest, you'll be playing?
Jack Burden.
Okay, and Jason Bale?
Sugar Boy O'Sheen. Sugar Boy.
So who is Willie Stark?
We've got an actor in from Jacksonville. His name is, he goes by W.C. Green professionally, but we just call him Billy.
Okay. Now, this, as I stated, it's a legendary play and book Pulitzer Prize winning book from Robert Penn Warren, who of course started the Southern Review at LSU, and Academy Award winning movie, and then a not so good movie with Sean Penn. How can you put a new twist on this?
Well, this is really interesting. Having been in the Swine Palace, we came to be in 1992 with a production of All the King's Men, a different translation. And this, I think this kind of tells the story that Robert Penn Warren wrote better than any of the ones. I haven't seen the Sean Penn version, but, you know,
you didn't miss a whole lot.
Having seen the Broderick Crawford, and, you know, we were really proud of our production. Back, it was Lucy Maycock's translation. This is Adrian Hall's translation. You know, so often it becomes the story of Willie Stark, whereas, especially when you do it down here, because yeah. Everybody sees the Huey P. Long correlation there. But... But you know, it's a story that this good versus evil, and how they coexist. You know, these hearing the debate earlier in here. It's like there are no absolutes, and I think we ask that question in this, and we don't really provide the answer in this production.
All the King's Men, Swine Palace's final production in the 2013 season. It starts tonight through Sunday, May 5th, so there'll be some time to see it if you wish.
Yeah, and I should say, too, really fast, Jim, that actually tonight's our last dress and our first public performance actually starts tomorrow night.
Okay. Now, is it open to the public tonight?
Tonight is not, no.
Okay.
Tomorrow
right.
night.
Well,
tomorrow night is.
I apologize. So no, actually, no April 17th, which is tomorrow. So I'm ahead of the game. So if you show up tonight, you might get a few people saying, you know,
we'll say
be
thanks
better to come tomorrow.
Take your reservations for
all
the
right.
next 3 weeks.
So thanks for the correction, Jason Bales. I mentioned both of you gentlemen are veterans, and Joe Crest, I recall you in a film that's 15 years old now, Dangerous Proposition.
Oh, I'm sorry you recall that.
I was in the film, too. But you were the main star.
That's right, yeah.
It wasn't bad.
No, it that was actually a lot of fun. Worked with one of my old buddies, MFA classmates, John Meese. It was one of the few opportunities we ever had to work together. But yeah.
Yeah, if you want to get a good look at Baton Rouge, that's a film where you can do it.
I think it was actually at one point entitled Baton Rouge.
It was. It was, and then it became Dangerous Proposition. Noelle Evans, the actress who was with it, she went on to big things, as did Catherine Dench.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, certainly.
It spawned some careers of fine actors of the stage and screen, like those and the gentleman who's with us, Joe Crest. And you've spent a lot of time in your career in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I first came to Louisiana back in the 80s, went to LSU and kind of fell in love with the place. And it's been, even in my 18 years in Los Angeles, it's always been as much a home to me as West Virginia, where I grew up.
Where do you live, Jason?
I live in Baton Rouge right now, actually.
And interestingly, Jason, you went to college where?
Northern Illinois University.
And one of your roommates was none other than the news director for the Louisiana Radio Network.
Jeff Blermo.
Standing about a few feet away from us right now. Yeah, your roommate.
Yeah.
What
a
small world that is.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing when I got my opportunity, actually, to come to LSU. And the only time I had ever been to Louisiana was to come down for Jeff's wedding, actually, in August of 2004, which was funny. And it was my first time here, but Baton Rouge was just kind of always that place down south, you know, being from Chicago. So it was a great bonus for us to have really close friends to come and
And you brought an instrument with you for any particular reason?
I did bring a guitar with me. The Adrian Hall adaptation features a lot of songs by Randy Newman, which is great. And we've worked the songs into the show to kind of really create an interesting mood and atmosphere that kind of reveals, you know, the emotional tensions that exist in the play between the characters and help push the story forward. We've got an incredible music director. His name is Brian Breen, and he's arranged these songs.
Can you do something right now for us? Jason Bale, who will be doing this in the production, I presume, which starts tomorrow night at Swine Palace in the main theater at the LSU Union Theater and Music and Dramatic Arts location. This is at the Riley Theater on Tower Drive, actually. It's the, I guess you could call that the main theater, but that's where the production is. Riley Theater, Tower Drive, tomorrow night through Sunday, May 5th, and here is Mr. Jason Bale.
What has happened down here is the winds have changed. Clouds roll in from the north and it starts to rain. It rained real hard, it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. River rose all day, river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River has busted clear down the Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Not bad.
Thank you.
I'm sure Randy Newman would be proud.
Yes, they are.
I think his version's better than Aaron Neville's.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. Thank you.
Jason's got an amazing voice, and there are so many beautiful voices. Jessica Jane,
who I know you know, yeah, too, sure. Jim, she's got a character that George has kind of created for her, Lady Jane, he calls her. But she actually sings the majority of the tunes, and she just goes into these blues numbers and jazz, and it just, her voice is so beautiful and powerful, and it's really, really something, I think.
Yeah,
to
she's used as a threat, kind of a voice inside Jack Burden's head that is a thread that sort of brings him in and out of the scenes that he's playing and where he's in his
head.
That's
not a bad voice to have in your head.
Yeah, it's not at all. So no, it's definitely something and we have you want to follow around.
It's a cast of about 32 or 33, yeah. And everybody does sing at different moments in the play. I don't want to give the impression necessarily that it's a musical. It's certainly a play with music, but there are certainly these very large ensemble moments musically, and it's powerful. It's great stuff.
Well, we're glad you moved to Louisiana, Jason.
I did.
And Joe Crest, you live in Los Angeles.
Well, no, we relocated here about 5 years ago.
So you were 18 years in Los Angeles, and you've actually moved here. So,
have, yeah.
Well, I guess you can do that now when you're in the movie industry. We had Michael Papajohn, who on the show last week.
Yeah, buddy of mine.
And he lives in Baton Rouge as well.
A lot of people are moving here. Let's just hope the tax credits continue and more people will be here like Jason and I. Yeah.
Well, how was it as a Louisiana boy who went to the West Coast to make it big? How was that experience?
Oh, it was terrific. But, you know, it's we always had this LSU, Louisiana little support group. We all lived in the same neighborhood. You know, we're still close, talk to each other every week. But
what neighborhood was that?
Well, we moved around, but when we first got there, it was the what's called the Miracle Mile. It's, you know, around where the farmers market, Wilshire and La Brea. And everybody was kind of in walking distance, and when someone else would graduate, they would kind of move into the area. So it was great. You know, we had crawfish boils and everything else.
Well, you're back home, and it starts officially tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., and for those who'd like more information, 225-578-3527. And this one is at the Riley Theater, which is another fine venue. Very, very good place for any production, and I would think for this one in particular. Thank you, Joe Kress. Thank you, Jason Bale. And good luck tonight, and good luck tomorrow night for the official opening and through May 5th and on and into your career. We'll keep in touch.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. Appreciate the visit. And we'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.